We live in a technological age, so this had to precede my greetings to you. Thank you very much for coming. I'm very grateful that I have this opportunity to speak here for the center. Can you hear me well? Is this loud enough?
No?
No? Okay. Welcome. Thank you for coming. It's better. I'm very grateful that I can have this opportunity to speak for the Center for the Restoration of Christian Culture here at Thomas More College. I would be wrong not to try to connect the purposes of this talk with the purposes of the center. So I want to start by contextualizing a little bit why I thought this might be a worthy subject to pursue for us in this context, before I then go into more details. So the center declares five areas of interest or focus in its effort to restore Christian culture. Our common work of discerning the person and the common good touches at least three of those five. So we consider, firstly, civic life. So the person and the common good are eminently political and moral concepts, and so fit very much into the very center of that concern for civic life. Being moral and political concepts, they also attach to family life, the second area of focus for the center. Thirdly, marriage as well. And perhaps less so, but still with points of contact with respect to education and culture as a whole, being the last two of those five. Now, there are then these reasons why one should think about the person and the common good, but I think there's also another reason why it's worthy to consider it in this work of restoration that the center has declared to be its purpose. Father Sokolowski, a Catholic philosopher at the Catholic University of America, in one of his essays concluded with very intriguing and fascinating remarks. He said something to the effect of the need to reform our categories of thinking, particularly the need to reform our categories of thinking into Christian categories of thinking. The way that I understand him there is to say that we ought to attempt to reform the words, the significations by which we consider and discuss and think through various problems and various situations of life. And it struck me that the person and the common good are two of those concepts that are profoundly important to consider reality, social, political, moral reality. So I think it is at the heart of the work of the center to work towards a kind of reform of our categories of mind, of thinking. Yeah? And so, accordingly, it is indeed our common work tonight that we want to arrive at an understanding, perhaps a definition, of two of those fundamental ideas that I suggest, and I hope we will see together, really ought to structure a way of thinking through moral, political, social, and perhaps even cultural questions. That by way of contextualizing why this seems to me to be a worthy talk for the center. Now, it would not be an overstatement to say that the 19th and 20th centuries are rich in confusion and misunderstandings and errors regarding the person and the common good. We think, of course, firstly about totalitarian regimes such as National Socialism or Soviet Communism, there are other forms of communism as well. What seems to be present in all of these perversions of political order and regimes is a misconception of the person and the common good. That is, a misconception of the persons which the government ought to serve, the very subjects of citizens, as well as that towards which the political authority ought to serve them. Yes. As one example, I would like to bring up, my friend Dominic there introduced me having studied Dietrich von Hildebrandt. So there's a neat example that I think illustrates this confusion about the person and the common good, the error and the consequences that those errors could incur, could cause. So in 1933, there was a conference by Catholic academics, 1933, an ominous year for Germany, yes, the year that Hitler came to power, united both the presidency and the chancellery into his person and basically unfolded the total state. At this conference in Marialach, a Benedictine abbey, famous later, already at the time for liturgical reforms and renewal, Abbot Herwegen, a famous abbot, very, very influential, again, liturgically, declared in the presence of brown shirts, meaning literally the walls around, like our assembly here, was lined with Nazis, declared in the presence of Nazis that there is reason to support the Nazi state, because the Nazi state is very much synonymous to the church, in that it equally shares a clear direction, a hierarchical structure to serve the common good and subordinate the members of that society to the common or good of the whole of the state. Now, to speak Albert Herwegen clear of any further accusation, a year later he recognized that he was terribly wrong and repented publicly for supporting the Nazi state and made good again. Now, what happened in the years leading up to this declaration or this pronouncement by Abbot Herwegen was a number of sociological conferences of which Hildebrand was a part. And Hildebrand in 1933 already had to flee Germany because the Nazis were in fact coming after him. And they were coming after him, again, for good reason, because he was an eminent defender of the dignity of the human person over and against what he anticipated to be abuses by the total state, a kind of absorption of the person endowed with the dignity for being created in the image and likeness of God, endowed with rationality and freedom to choose and discern the good that is common to all of us as human beings, that there would be abuses that would reduce the person to a mere part, a mere tool in the cog of the state machine. And at these conferences, unfortunately, a part of Catholic intellectuals decided to emphasize and overemphasize the good of the whole, the common good, at the expense, so he thought, and he rightly thought, at the expense of the good of the person, and particularly the dignity of the person. The particular arguments are fascinating, but I don't wish to overburden us with those, but suffice it to say that Hildebrand argued that when we consider the dignity of the person lying in ultimately its origin and its final end and its nature, his, her nature, the natural community of the state does not compare in dignity to the person. That was Hildebrand's argument. There's some interesting facets here and there, and that would be very worthy to explore at another time. But I bring this up because these confusions about persons and common good really determine how we respond to social, political, and moral realities and may find ourselves on the wrong side of the aisle, so to say. Now, I think we can do well to consider another important point about the person and the common good, and which really is the perspective that I want to take in addition to kind of a historical contextualization, is the fact that the person and the common good are the first two of the fundamental principles of Catholic social teaching. So, the compendium to the social compendium to the catechism teaches that there are four fundamental principles that comprise the very center heart of the Catholic Church's social teaching. The first one is the person, truly first and fundamental. The second one is the common good. The third one being subsidiarity, and the fourth one being solidarity. So we're approaching, and I really want to stress in an introductory manner, the first two of those concepts. Now, when we consider the history of, or the birth of Catholic social teaching, we must look back into the 19th century. And we must look to the famous encyclical by Leo XIII, Rerum Novarum, New Things, or the New Developments, if you wish. And what happened at the time, what prompted the Pope Leo, to write an encyclical on the social question was we might well call it social disorder, grounded in a misunderstanding and error about the person and about the common good, and particularly the political common good. Meaning that liberalism at the time considered the person as merely an individual without any natural social inclinations, and therefore also no social fulfillment or teleology. And socialism, the critic of liberalism, at the same time reduced the person to a mere part of a whole, a collective whole, in which the personal goods, the intrinsic dignity of the person endowed with a rational soul was not recognized. And most importantly, since it was atheistic, God as the common good of all human beings was not recognized. Now, Leo XIII considered this social order to be defective, and so it was, because a whole class was reduced to subhuman, this may be a little bit of an overstatement, but less than dignified living standards. We talk here about the working classes. Now, for our purposes, what's important is that the encyclical very clearly lays out a proper conception of the person, a proper conception of the common good, and identifies in strongest terms that the state, the political association, is responsible for the attainment of the common good. And that the social bond must be one that has to be strengthened through the state, and that bond consists firstly of justice and secondly of charity. The person and the common good in that encyclical, as throughout the history and all the documents of Catholic social teaching, both of these concepts are practical concepts. And in two ways. What do I mean by practical? I mean, firstly, that they are concepts by which we evaluate, judge, social actions and conditions. Think again about Hildebrand, for example, but think also about Leo XIII. Looking at a social condition, a social order, and judging it, saying, this does not correspond to the dignity of the person. This does not correspond to the common good and the work or the task of the state. So they are practical concepts insofar as they are concepts by which we evaluate and judge social action and conditions. But they're also directive or determinative concepts insofar as when we want to engage, when we must engage in social action and social choices and decisions, we ought to consider what we do, what we propose to be done, in reference to those concepts, those realities. So they are, if you wish, they are the two of the four anchors by which we want to understand and construct or work towards a social order that is truly respectful of the person, and thus being respectful of the person, truly pursues the common good. Now, what do we learn about the person? What is a person? And what does the church find the person's dignity? And I want to share a few of the elements that make up the church's thinking through the dignity of the person, some of which I already have brought up because they are, in fact, somewhat knowable to us by our experience of ourselves, by our experience of others, and by our experience of community and friendships that we have. But we'll move somewhat from revelation to nature in the order of considering the dignity of the person. Yes. So what was already mentioned, man is created in the image and likeness of God. Now, St. Thomas Aquinas, in the prologue to the first part of the second part of the Summa Theologica, has the following to say about the work that he's now going to do, which is to embark on a study of the human person. And I want you to underline the tremendous dignity that speaks through these words. This is what St. Thomas says, and this has been quoted many, many times, and rightly so. Now that we have treated of the exemplar, that is God, and of those things which came forth from the power of God in accordance with his will, it remains for us to treat of his image, that is, of man. Inasmuch as he too is the principle of his actions, as having free will and control of his actions. Meaning, we, the image of the exemplar, share in the exemplar's freedom and control over his own actions. Not sharing in his actions, of course, not in his control over his actions, but sharing the same control and freedom over our own actions. The second point I wish to make regarding the dignity of the human person that I take to be essential for the church and in the church's teachings. This is profoundly and beautifully presented in St. John Paul II's Evangelium Vitae, a wonderful encyclical, the Gospel of Life. There we learn, the saint, the Holy Father, tells us, first of all, life, human life, is a divine gift. We have dignity because of the origin of our existence, being in God. And we have dignity because of the end of our existence, being eternal life with God. So, both the divine origin, our divine origin, and our divine calling to eternal life with him are sources of our dignity. Another source of our dignity that the Holy Father brings up is Christ's sacrifice on the cross for us. Again, I think this shows the great worth. Dignity is a word that comes from worth and value. The great worth that man has in the eyes of God, of the supreme good, the supreme being. So much so that he would send his only son to die for us on the cross and redeem us into everlasting life with him. What else can we learn about the dignity and the nature of the human person? We already brought out the fact that man is a rational animal. We have reason, and because we have reason, we rise above our material circumstances, the circumstances of space and time, yeah? And thus we can truly be said to possess a spiritual nature as opposed to a merely material corporal nature, which we possess as well. This is again the ground for our being self-directed, being participants in the realization of our own fulfillment and perfection. Now, fifthly, what we can learn about the human person, having now talked a little bit about the dignity of the person, is that in addition to being rational, we are social or political animals. And we are so, again, because of our rationality, firstly, but also because of our social inclinations. That is to say that we, as human beings, are inclined to form friendships. The greatest example, of course, would be the friendship of marriage. That Aristotle would say that there is a first community or communion of human beings that is formed by the communion of husband and wife, who cannot be without one another. And they are truly moving towards one another as something, an intrinsic movement, a movement that comes from within that we don't rationally discern necessarily, that is the movement as such, the particular person we should rationally discern. Now, let me give you an example again about the difference between, or the distinguishing feature of the human person with respect to the contrast to animals. It is somewhat a tradition to compare the human person to compare and contrast the human person to other social animals, what Aristotle calls social animals, like bees and ants. You know? Now, bees and ants may be called social because they have a unity, a cohesion, and they work together for the common purpose, in this case the survival of the hive or the nest, yeah. And they do so in an orderly manner and what we could call in a harmonious manner. Right? So you don't tend to see, we don't think that this is so, and we know that it's not, we don't tend to see ants fighting with one another or bees arguing with one another. We also tend not to see a particularly productive ant arguing with a lazy ant about why they should do the job that they have before them. So these social animals have a unity, a cohesion, and a harmony by which and in which they work towards the good of the nest. But bees do not act, nor ants do act, not act knowingly. What is it that they do not know? Well, we can say that as animals we have sense knowledge. Yes, through our organs of sense we can perceive various material things. This we share with the animals. But reason transcends those the particular knowledge of sense and arrives at universal knowledge. We can form universal concepts of things. So let's think this through with respect to the bees and the ants. While they, each individual ant works for the common good, so to say, we're gonna, as you know, notice we haven't defined it yet, we'll get there, but work together for the good of the hive, the nest, they don't know that good to be a good for all. They don't know that good to be their good. And they don't love that good on that account either. They are moved to that good and in their actions by instinct, which we can understand as nearly being moved as if by another. Moved as if by another. Yes? They do that no matter what. Yeah. By contrast, human beings, when they form societies, they think through that which they form. How do they think through that which they form? Well, first and foremost, they think through what kind of society we want to form. Now, again, there are societies that are that we're naturally inclined to form. There are societies that are purely conventional. A soccer club is a purely conventional thing. There's nothing particularly human about soccer in itself. Yes? As a sport and as a play, full activity, that is so. But the particular, there's no necessity for the human person to play soccer. Yeah. We may do that. We may start a singing club. Yes. So we think through what kind of association or society do we want to form. And then we think through how do we want to organize that. Yeah. Now, as we think through what do we want to form or found, it seems to me that we do a couple of things. One, we discern that which we found to be somehow good for us. And we tend to found associations with others who also think that the association and what it pursues is good for them too. And so it's hardly the case that if we want to found a singing club that the person we found it with thinks that singing is completely absurd and shouldn't be done and there's no investment and no good for him at all. And so we found associations because we take them to be good. Yeah? And by the way, we also judge associations because we take them to be good or not. And then in the work of ordering the parts, that is, the members, to that good, we again proceed rationally and say, okay, how do we want to accomplish that good of our association? How do we want to accomplish singing together? Do we want to meet once a week, twice a week? Do we want to have a professional conductor? Or how do we want to do that? It, of course, gets more complex when we think about more complex associations like political societies. Now, what is further curious and distinguishes the human person from, say, ants or bees societies is that, for example, in human societies, we tend to honor those members who have merited to be honored on account of their having contributed to the work of the association in a special and unique manner. So we have monuments in this country. We have monuments to various presidents, many presidents. We also have monuments to soldiers, perhaps. We have monuments to scientists at times. I was just in Germany with my family. There are monuments to bishops, cardinals, outside of cathedrals and churches. Now, what happens in those cases is that the human person, human societies, judge the work of individual members of those associations to be particularly productive, beneficial to the society as a whole. Yeah, so if we think about, we were just in Mainz, which is where St. Boniface was bishop for the latter part of his life and from where he evangelized the Germans. There's a beautiful statue right in front of it. Well, of course, because he was a great beneficiary to Catholics in Germany. So we as humans and human societies, we tend to do things very differently from even social animals because we do them rationally. We discern the ends for which the associations exist. We discern the order that is most conducive to attaining those ends. And we recognize persons that have worked in an extraordinary, meritorious way towards the fulfillment or the perfection of the association's end. Now, another little thing about the human person, about us, is, of course, that we can also refuse to work together in the association. We can also be selfish. Yeah, we can take our membership in an association to be not for the good of the whole. We can refuse to say, I'm going to link arms with my fellows and work together, and I can order the good of the association merely to myself. Yes, I want to bring this up because I just read this with my 5-year-old. There's a story by Oscar Wilde called The Selfish Giant. Some of you may know The Selfish Giant. And there is a giant is away for many, many years with his friend, I think it's the ogre. And he comes back only to find a group of kids, children, playing in the garden of his castle. And the giant is selfish. So what does he do? He puts a wall around the garden and expels the children. Now what's going on here? Now Oscar Wilde is, of course, right to call him a selfish giant. What's going on here? What's going on in these other examples? Again, what we see there is a good that... Let me actually bring up another example so that we can complete the various examples. Another example, something that I run into in classes a lot because I have the privilege of sometimes teaching this text, is taken from the Iliad. Many of you, maybe all of you know the Iliad, yes? There is this fabulous scene when furious Achilles is in pursuit of Hector and chases him around the city of Troy over and over. Neither can really Hector escape, nor can Achilles ever really get to him. And at this point, what we already know is that, one, Achilles, in killing Hector, will bring about his own death very, very shortly. But we also know that if Hector dies, Troy will fall. It is not as clear-cut as that, but it is hinted at that will be the consequence, and in fact is the consequence. So again, Achilles is chasing Hector. Now Hector then is deceived by a god into thinking that there is one of his brothers next to him. So he finally has the confidence with another to face the furious Achilles. And he stops. And now they're face-to-face. Now, the god is deceiving him, disappears, he finds himself alone. And then in that moment, he thinks through his options. From the city walls, his mother, his father, shout, come into the city. Come into the city. Don't face this man. Don't face this man who happens to have just wrestled with a river, who happens to just more or less single-handedly defeated the entire Trojan army. Come into the city walls. Come into safety and remain a living part of the defense of the city and all of its members and all of its families, including your own. What does Hector do? He stays outside the city walls because he's ashamed to go into the city. Not because he's ashamed of walking away from the fight with Achilles. That's not what he would be ashamed of. What he's ashamed of is that he previously made the wrong decision to keep the army, the Trojan army, camped outside the city walls against the better counsel of one of his friends. And therefore now is responsible for the death of so many. So he stays outside, and he's very clear that likely he will die. But he doesn't want to incur the shame of going into the city walls and that friend of his saying, "I told you so." So he stays outside. Now, let's take the selfish giant and take Achilles and Hector. Both of those, I propose, point to the common good and in contradistinction to a private good and what happens when human beings choose the private good over the common good, and also as a way into understanding common goods. So, the garden, the giant's garden, is enjoyed by many children. The giant comes back, puts a wall around it, he expels the children, and thus effectively keeps that pleasure of the garden from them and keeps it for himself. Now the story ends by him tearing down the walls and everyone plays together in the garden. But what is going on in that case is that the garden is a common good for the community, or for the friends, children and giant. And they can all play in it together. And there's almost no loss to any one of them being in the garden together. They can all enjoy it, and it's pleasant to be in that garden. With Hector and Achilles, Hector not going into the city, what we see there is that the common good of the city, or the good of the city, its survival, which of course is a good that would be shared in by all of its members, those surviving members, yes, is compromised for the sake of avoiding the shame. Meaning, the good that would extend to many is compromised for the sake of procuring a merely private good, namely his own, avoiding of the shame. So what can we learn about these very elementary, examples about the common good? Well, first of all, common goods are goods of communities. That would be a preliminary observation. But in terms of a definition, we could say that common goods are those goods that are one and that can be shared in by many without diminishing them. Common goods are goods that are one that can be shared in by many without diminishing it. So let's take the survival of the city again. It is a common good because many can share in it, like everyone can live in the city and enjoy its survival, its existence, without that very thing, the city itself, being diminished in any way. It doesn't become less of a city or becomes... And what is being enjoyed there is nearly all of the city. A counterexample would be, let's take a pizza. Again, a pizza can be the good that a community of friends decides to use to satisfy its hunger in an evening. When the pizza arrives, what happens is that the friends all help themselves to the pizza. Now, the pizza can be said to be a kind of common good, but notice what happens, that it cannot be shared in, that is, I cannot partake in it without diminishing it. When I take a piece away, I truly took a piece away. That piece is no longer part of the pizza. Another example would be driving on the road. Roads are common goods. Many of us can share in it, but imperfectly. How so? You could say, well, you can drive in it, you can drive on it, I can drive on it. Well, yes, but we can't all drive in the same spot of the road. Right? So In effect, by me sharing in that common good of the road, I reduce the availability of that good for everyone else, namely by one, the size of my car or so, I guess. Now, in the order of goods, the more common goods are those that can be shared more perfectly. That means without loss or without being diminished or split. So that also means that spiritual goods tend to be more perfect as common goods than material goods. The pizza is a less perfect common good than the city. But let's take an example like truth. To share in the truth, if I share in the truth about the human person, my sharing in it does not diminish that truth whatsoever. It doesn't make it less available to any one of you. In fact, in sharing in the truth of the person, we all share in the same good, one and whole and all. We don't diminish it at all. So let's recapitulate for a moment so that we'll see where we're at. So we've talked about the occasion to think through the person and the common good. We've tried to understand what the church teaches about the dignity of the person and the nature of the human person. And we then talked about various examples in which the relationship between person and common good comes out, and saw some examples of common goods and their distinction into more perfect, less perfect, material, and spiritual goods. And we've seen that, again, the more perfect tends to be the spiritual, the less perfect tends to be the material good. There are other ways in distinguishing common goods, and I want to mention them and then talk a little bit about the good as such. So we saw in the case of the garden that was a pleasant good. It's a pleasant good. Traditionally, we tend to distinguish the good or goods into pleasant, useful, and honorable or noble goods. And so the pizza would be a useful good. The road would be a useful good. The garden would be a pleasant good. And an honorable good would be a good that is good in itself and for its own sake. Something that we would pursue for its own sake, like truth. We don't pursue truth because it is useful for us. It can be, but to know the truth as such is something that we would do for its own sake. I like to know. Aristotle says all human beings desire to know. Yeah. And it's pleasant to know the truth, but that's not the reason why we pursue it. Pursue it because it's good in itself, pleasant or not. Now, a few more comments about goods in general. So the good is the principle of action. That is to say that we would never move to anything unless we perceived something to be good, to be desirable, something to be done or accomplished. Yes? So the good is that object of our desire that is the principle of action in the first place. We could say that without desires are stimulated by goods, nothing moves. Now, the good has the nature of an end or a goal. That is, it's that for the sake of which we do things, we move. And there are orders among goods. There is an order among goods. There are goods that are final or ultimate goods, and then there are goods that are penultimate goods, and there are goods that are merely useful for those penultimate and ultimate goods. So again, for example, if I want to meet a friend in Manchester, I may determine many different means to get there. These are all instrumental or useful for me to get ultimately to where I want to go. I choose a road, I choose a car, a transportation, all these goods I choose in order to get to where I want to go. There's a hierarchy of goods. And in this hierarchy, we will see that the common good is actually, or common goods are higher and prior to less perfect common goods and private goods. Meaning, When we think about the common good, goods have the nature of an end. They are those which move us, prompt our desires so that we move towards them in the first place. Then there are common goods, goods that can be shared by many without being diminished, less common goods, less perfect common goods. And then there are private goods, goods that just cannot be shared at all. So if we think about the pizza again, or a cask of wine, or just a glass of wine. A glass of wine that I drink cannot be shared. It's my glass. I'm drinking it. That cannot be shared. It's impossible to do so. That's a private good. Now, a cask of wine, again, could be a common good, but my share of that is, again, not the one that's shareable. Yeah? I drink that. It's my private good. Okay. So what we've tried to do was to find ways to arrive at conceptions and understanding of person and common good by way of some examples. I want to make two more points here towards the end. As a family man, and all of us being part of associations and communities, and all of us have at least been children, possibly our parents, we notice that from the very beginning of life, there's a constant effort of integrating members into the association and making them into more perfect members of the association. So this is particularly prevalent right now because we have a 5-year-old who is really hard to integrate into the common work of the family. Yeah? We have help, but that doesn't oftentimes work out. So very, very early on, the parents try to raise their children into participants, members of the family, who of course has a common order into which the child is to be integrated, and a common purpose, namely the good of the family as a whole. And that this is a good of persons. So the point I'm trying to make, that I want to make, is that the common good is the good of persons. And eminently so. Let's take the common good par excellence, God. Remember our definition. The common good is a good that is one that can be shared by many without being diminished. God can be shared by all of us without being diminished. And he's the highest good. But as persons, we are ordered towards that good in a supreme manner. He is our personal good as much as he is our common good. One last point. What does that look like to understand God as a common good? We all know St. Teresa's autobiography, or many of us do. There is the impression that St. Teresa can make that she really wants God for herself. Like she says things like, God, Jesus, her one and only love, so to say, yeah? That she can't wait to be united to her beloved, that she is willing to give up herself, complete act of self-abasement, to be united with her beloved. And it seems like, it's false, but it would seem like, oh, this is a person wanting God and Jesus for herself. But then, you may all recall, there's this moment where this famous criminal, Pranzini, is to be executed. And St. Therese submits sacrifices and sufferings to God, imploring him to give Pranzini the grace to recognize him, to be touched by his grace, and to be moved to love him. What's going on there in a most beautiful way is that St. Therese is saying, yes, God is my good, and I want to be united with my beloved. But God, Jesus, you are also the good of Pranzini. You're the good of all human beings. And she loves him as a common good. She doesn't love him as a good that she wants just for herself. She wants to share God with Pranzini, a criminal. And so when we think about how do we as persons relate to common goods, well, we wish them for others. We want to share them with others, and we wish to glorify, in God's case it's very easy, wish to glorify and protect and preserve that good for others and ourselves. What time is it? Yes, thank you very much for your attention. Appreciate it. Yes, please. Questions for clarifications, please, anything. Yeah. Yes.
Those, it seems to me, in listening to the common good, it's somewhere, it relates somehow to living in, to being drawn into community, seeking the good, and seeking God.
Yes. So let me just make sure that I understand. So you're rightly laying out these various components of the natural law, you know, being both inclinations, but also being kind of the directives as to how to respond to goods and that greater, and they're intrinsic or natural to us, yes. And so, yeah, when we think about common goods, then we can say that, yes, so a community, life in a community is, in fact, a common good and a personal good at the same time. So we have a natural inclination to be in community with others, yeah, and that is shared by all. We all have that, yeah. Now, when it comes to thinking then about the common good is not good or is not common because many want it or many share in it. When we think about the common good, we want to make sure that we think about it as common because of its nature and because of its communicability. So if I said something like, well, we all desire community, therefore community is a common good, that would not be the way that we want to think about common goods. Rather, we want to say, no, a common life, a city, for instance, or a state, offering really the fullness of human life, is a common good because it is one thing that can be shared by many without being diminished. It's not common because many want it or many have an inclination or per se. Yeah. Does that correspond to what you... Okay. Yeah. Mr. MacArthur. Dr. MacArthur. Yeah, so that's interesting. If I understand the question, I would say that give you an example to see if I get what you mean. So the husband and father who faces defending his family against an invader is willing to put his life on the line and perhaps loses his life. We could say in that same instance, in what sense is the good of the family, the common good of his family, a good for him? Is that somewhat along the same lines?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah. Is that the answer? It is in a way good for him?
Yes, I think so. And it is, one way I think about it is at the moment of intervening or acting in protection and defense of the family, it is in fact his and a common good. And so it's in the moment of taking the action, the motive or the good in question is a common good, and it's his good too, because as a member of the family, he is as a person enjoying and benefiting from a good that in this case is a community of which he is a part. Now, of course, once he then is, say, he's dead, then you could say, well, then he's lost all of that. But in the moment, he does, and it is his good. So in the case of, you know, now of course if someone else throws you overboard, but again there, the common, in what sense is it right to sacrifice one's own, if you wish, private good for the common good? Yeah. And it is, I think it can only be said because it is in fact the person's good that can be lost together with other goods, but it is the person's good. I'm not sure if I'm answering your question perfectly. Supersede the personal dignity. I'm not sure. I don't think that I want to say that, because again, if we take the source and ground of human dignity, these are all goods that are shared, right? So shareable. God is the source of our existence and end of our existence. So all of that which gives us dignity are also common goods. Now, it may be the case that a particular common good does not correspond to the highest calling of the person. That may be the case, but then, but there again, I don't think that you can say that the person has dignity that somehow competes with common goods. But I would have to think about that more. That's a great question. Right. Yeah. So they're talking about the primacy of the common good over the private good or the individual's good in that case. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, as my wife said the other day, it seems to be just a matter of arithmetic. I mean, quite simply, in a way, I think that's true. So the common good is a good for many. Yeah. Whereas the criminal endangering that good of many, being one, it's just less than the many, and by that function is not to be the cause of a destruction or a danger to the many and their good. Now, if you take them, okay. So if the common good is something that is tyrannically determined, yeah, like it was by the Nazis, and you say, okay, you are an enemy of the state by virtue of being of a different ethnicity or race or something like this. Yeah, I think there is a number of problems, I suppose, but on the one hand, it is the typically ideological or totalitarian way of thinking in terms of classes and classifying human beings and judging them by way of belonging to a class rather than looking at them as persons who can be more or less good or bad depending on their character and so forth. But that's certainly a problem where you actually see that there the judgment is not made in defense of a genuine common good and of persons, but a person there is already reduced to something that he's not, and treated then as, and judged and treated as something that he or she was not, as you rightly say. So, yeah.
Let me just ask one further question based on what you just said. Now, yeah. So can we say that a determination of something as common good is invalid? Let's go back to that definition we have of common good. It seems to me you said it was a good that could be shared by many without being diminished. Mm-hmm. Not be diminished. in which case the common good of getting rid of the particular ethnic group is an invalid.
Right. So depending on the kinds of communities we have, we can use the word all in different ways, right? So we can say, on the one hand, when we have a community like a college, and we say that community has a good truth, knowledge, wisdom, then that common good should be truly a good for all members, yeah, of that community. Now, you could, the next community, perhaps, that we could consider there, because there are more members, is the community of the city or the state. And that seems to be there the violation in Nazi Germany, for instance, was that there were citizens who were members of the community of the state or the city as the state, and were not beneficiaries of the good that the state was to procure. So they were excluded from the good that the state exists to bring about for them. Yeah. Now there again, you have more, and there, you know, in the political association, all members of that association have a claim on the good that the association is supposed to be providing. Now you also have, in a more abstract sense, the community of all human beings. Yes? There you have the idea of all par excellence. That's truly all, and that's when you then see, okay, what is the common good of all? That's then God. Yeah? But you can't say that. All have a claim on being, in that sense of all of human beings, have a claim to be or should benefit from my soccer club or something like that. They're not members of those. But in terms of being members of an association, of course, then the common good of that association ought to and can only then be truly common. And it's actually a measure, a kind of evaluative standard to see, okay, is that truly a good for all or not? Is that a common good? You could say that, I think. I'm not sure, am I getting... Right, yeah. Yeah, I think that's a great question. Well, I think the easiest, perhaps the simplistic, the most simple answer would be, well, let's look at their account of the person. Yeah, and then we can see, okay, what do we learn about the person? You know, if it's truly the case that man is created in the image and likeness of God, rationality, the power to discern good and evil, and order his actions accordingly, versus a kind of account of the human being that is really just willing on the one hand, or really just equal freedom or liberty on the other. Then you can say, okay, that's where then you have to have the starting point. You can go even further and say, actually, what's underlying many of these contemporary ideas of the person are materialistic conceptions of the person, be that biological, neuroscientific, you know, where all actions are actually reducible to material processes of the brain or something like this. Yeah. So there again, I think, there you would want to begin thinking through to demonstrate the true nature of the person, the true dignity of the person, the social nature of the person. You have to show those qualities first. And I think once you do that, then you can also arrive at a notion of genuine common goods that are common goods common for persons, thus defined and understood. Right, so right now, we can't say to a... perhaps not to all, I don't want to generalize unjustly, but it seems to me that to say that God is the common good of all human beings, it's a very problematic idea. But it's not when you understand, okay, human beings are called to eternal union with God. So then you kind of circumvent, I mean, you talk on different levels based on your account of the person. So if you have the wrong account of the person, how can you arrive at genuine common goods? Because they are goods of the persons. Am I getting to?
It's like if, when liberals talk about human dignity, which they do a lot.
Yes.
You could say, well, I'm not disagreeing with you, but what I would have to do is look under the hood.
What do you mean by human? I would always ask the question. Yeah, so.
You could say, well, we could both agree that, you know, Nazi Germany is bad, or the communist Russia is bad, or the 19th century, satanic liberals are bad, for the same reason, because we use the same language. But you're going to say that my method is better because of what goes into that language. When I say dignity, there's more to it than what you could possibly do.
Yeah, it's true, yes, right. Yeah, and I think that if you do that, if you ask in these conversations, I think it's always good to come to understand the concepts and the terms that are being used, right? So it's, you're right, they use the same terms, but they signify different things, right? So to say that one acts in defense of human dignity oftentimes simply means to act in defense of anyone's personal wishes and desires, regardless of what they are. Like, you know, one of the kind of funny phrases that I think express oftentimes very well what we're surrounded by is, as long as it makes you happy. As long as it makes you happy. Right? And it's a kind of reduction of, again, the person into an open playing field, open possibilities, an area of self-realization with indifference towards this or that good, that what makes a particular way of life good is not something intrinsic to that way of life, but the fact that I chose it. Yeah. And that's kind of a tyranny of indifferent reason, indifferent willing to any good, and that human dignity and equality simply means the protection of indifferent choices. Meaning, you may choose that or that. I mean, we can go to very extremes here. I will leave it at that. Does that make some sense? And so, whereas on the other hand, an account of a true account of human freedom, yeah, would have to begin by understanding the rationality of the human person, what reason is capable of discerning, human nature, teleology, right, what are we inclined to, natural law, what are we ordered towards, and that freedom ultimately is impossible without the truth. Freedom is ordered to the truth and derives from the truth. How do we know the truth? Well, we have to come to know it, to learn it. I hope I'm getting it.
It's very interesting, but it does it's kind of a boring. If you engage a liberal issue of slavery, you may wind up both agreeing that it's bad, but for very different reasons, the conversation's not going to go really any further.
Yeah, I think that that's a very interesting example. I mean, I think that that's right, that we could probably agree just on the level of using words that we would both use or both parties would use, like it's inhumane, it's below the human dignity of person. I think we would, but then you ask the question, well, what about it is so wrong? Both would say it's very wrong. But then there may be, bless you, maybe very different reasons. And so I think it's always important to ask, but what do you mean by, what is slavery to you? Why is it unjust? I agree it's unjust. Why do you think it's unjust? Thank you very much for your attention. Appreciate it.
Thank you all for coming out tonight. If you give me a few moments, I'll clear up the back and we'll have some refreshments afterwards. We can continue the conversation. Also, please, if you haven't put down your name or signed up for our newsletter, please do. We're hoping to continue these lectures, and your attendance, support, and being aware of those, spreading the word, is absolutely integral to making these things happen. Thank you very much. Have a good night.